Hello, welcome back to the Kaddish Galleries podcast Q&A. This is the one where we talk to Angela Rose Wilson about her recent exhibition in the Morrissey Gallery called 1,000 Sleeping Horses. The exhibition consisted of a series of experimental ink drawings. They're beautiful and haunting drawings, stark and personal, and you can see them on her website, AngelaRoseWilson.com. We had a great conversation. However, I do want to note that jazz practice began in the auditorium, so there is some background noise. I apologize for that. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Angela Rose Wilson. Where should we begin? Do you guys have anything you want to start with? I thought I'd, like, for the purposes of an archive, to ask you about your history here.
I came to St. Ambrose as a transfer student from a community college in St. Louis.
Okay.
So I had at that time an option between University of Iowa and St. Ambrose, and I met with Kristen Quinn in her studio, in her office, and we put all of my drawings out. I just felt like it was a very supportive environment, and I had some challenges. Growing up, I was diagnosed with a behavior disorder, not told what it was exactly, but I had a lot of issues with attention, and I just felt like naturally the faculty here was very accommodating of that, even though I don't think I ever had to articulate exactly what my issues were, but definitely I struggled.
At the time, would you have had the resource center and the accommodation system, or was this before
that was really there? I definitely made use of it. Okay. But it for me, it was just more staying caught up with assignments and organization. And, you know, it really was, it was a time when girls weren't diagnosed with ADHD, and I was diagnosed later as an adult. So, I think if it weren't for St. Ambrose, I don't know, you know, if I could have made it in any other kind of academic institution, not like University of Iowa, where I felt like I would have disappeared into the into those larger number of students. And it was a different time. Like I said, you know, I could go to the office and ask for accommodations, but I didn't really know what to tell them.
So, you didn't really have that diagnosis.
Because, you know, often with those type of challenges, a lot of what you feel is just that you're lazy, or you know, like the little boy in Charlie Brown with the dust cloud over his head. I mean, it was a disaster. So it was a struggle. I also came in as a non-traditional student with as a single mother with a toddler. So I was lucky. I just really landed in the right spot at the right time, and it changed my life. So
Did you feel like the community college system worked for you to get you that place, or was that something that you worked through that? Was it helpful or a hindrance, I guess?
I think it was helpful. I mean, I definitely needed a bridge. I left school. I didn't graduate as a traditional high school student. I had to sit for a GED exam. So, I mean, I had all of those things to overcome. I didn't have high school transcripts. So I definitely needed that year. And I think I was there for about a year, just to establish a GPA and also to feel out what it was, where I wanted to go with my life. I had challenges, and I started off in community college as a biology major because I had an interest in medicine, actually. So, but I had always drawn and painted as a child. What happened was I had become lost, had wandered through St. Louis Community College at Forest Park, and ended up, I think it was like on the top floor, and walked past the studio classrooms with all the easels, and my heart just draw. I was like, what is this place? You can study art? You can do that? You know, I didn't even know
that. You didn't really have that in your family history?
Absolutely not. No. Yeah. My exposure to art were Grant Wood prints at my elementary school, John Holliday posters. I'm trying to think. And my parents' record album collection, which I studied for hours because that's all I had to pull from. But I don't know. It was enough, I guess.
Crazy.
Yeah. So I just wondered, yeah.
Sorry.
At that point, I just ran down to my
doors to the lobby.
Advisor, and I said, I want to change my major.
So, wow.
She looked at my transcripts and she said, well, you know, actually, you if you take summer classes, you can, you know, we can do this. And I mean, and I didn't tell my family. I didn't tell anyone.
Wow.
I think my grandmother cried when I told her I was coming to St. Ambrose to major in art. So,
not tears of joy. Not tears of joy.
Right. Tears
of joy. Are you first generation or?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In a way, my mother was adopted, and my adoptive grandparents had college educations. But on my father's side, no one, and my mother didn't. So.
So it was a rarity. They were really putting a lot of pressure on you to move forward, and then you said, "I really want to study
all
art."
All hopes were on me.
Oh, that's a lot of pressure, and I'm sure it's a lot of pressure that a lot of us have felt. I know I sold my dad's into computers, and he had put together he and I had put together this great computer to go to college back at a time when it was still a very expensive proposition to have your own computer in here. And I sold that to go to New York for the summer for a painting program.
Oh.
We didn't talk for like a year. It was brutal, you know.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, I had, it, you know, when you discover these things, you just have to do them, right?
I mean, I had no choice. I mean, I really felt so compelled. It was like magnetic pull. I had to do it. I mean, I just knew. And even now, in my late 40s, I don't know if I made the right decision.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
I think all the time. I mean, who knows until.
That's right.
Until whenever your story ends, you don't know.
But, yeah.
I had something in me I wanted to say, and that's haunted my work from day one. I just didn't necessarily have the foundational skills to develop that, and then of course, I was so terrified when I started learning how to paint and draw. I only wanted to draw from observation because that's where my skills were naturally. So I would only do portraits of myself because I couldn't, create everything I saw in my mind, or, you know, I didn't figure out yet how to make that leap from representation to full imagination. And I'm still not quite there, but it's definitely gotten better with practice.
So you're in a middle space where you're really observing the world and capturing things, but it seems like narrative enters in a little bit, maybe even despite the journalistic aspect of the work. I mean, you're capturing a thing, but stuff seems to enter in. I don't know. Storytelling enters in, imagination enters in.
I hope that there seems to be, that it moves people emotionally, like there's a something in the work that people feel. I don't know if they, you know, it's what guides me. I mean, I still can't tell you quite why I'm attracted to a figure in this pose, or, you know, why I leave certain things out and put other things in. I'm guided entirely by intuition, to be honest. So, and I make a lot of work that I consider to be failures, you know, experiments. So probably what I show is maybe 10 or 15% of the total output in that period of time. And and I'm a big believer in that, that you make a lot of work so that you can choose the best of many rather than set out to make the one masterpiece. It's too much pressure for anyone to put themselves under.
You think there is some aspect of the ADHD that defines that process for you, where you're really effective in that churn versus, you know, I mean, I only say that because I feel like I'm like OCD, the opposite direction, right? Like one thing only, and I can't get out of it. It can go on for months and I can't get out of it. Like I'm trapped in it and I'm wishing I could just start a second thing and I can't let myself. So I'm just curious if you think there's anything to that.
Yeah, I think it's right there in my work. You know, it's that feeling of like, oh, it's not quite finished. Like, it's kind of moving from thing to thing before taking it to the full. But in a way, but the opposite of that for me was laboring over, like a hyper focus of laboring over something until it lost sort of an effervescent, it just was so, like too many layers, too much muck. It was just like buried so deeply under all this paint. I like ink because there isn't really an editing process. It's just sort of like do it and then set it aside and move on. And I don't actually evaluate the work until like for a couple of weeks after I've made it. So I wait.
You work quickly, set it aside, don't look back.
And then I look back and think, oh, this is interesting. And this is something that I can, and that becomes like a springboard for the next body of work.
So these ink drawings, they are made directly from life?
No, not at all. It's a collection of references from Wiki Commons.
Oh, really?
Family photos.
Oh, family photos. Okay,
yeah,
got it.
There are a lot of different. I have binders of things I've ripped out or printed, or because, like I said, I use. For me, being naturally adept at drawing from observation was almost a handicap because I was so afraid to let go and just allow the images to be imperfect, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like to allow for distortions or, you know, things. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of keep them, those images for reference as like a little bit of a crutch, but there are other drawings I've done where I am allowing myself to draw from memory or stream of consciousness. And I remember hearing an interview of with an improvisational comedian actor, and the process for them is to say yes always to everything. And once I started to bring that into my studio, it changed my practice, because I was so hard on myself and every idea was like, no. And then one day I was just like, okay, draw this and the eye is here and, you know, and there's a horse coming out here and yes, whatever is there. And that just opened like the doors to my creative process. And it was so freeing. So I say yes to everything, but I don't show everything.
On reflection, maybe that one's not. Yeah.
But I think it's important to have a place in your studio where a journal or a sketchbook or whatever it is, where you give every idea a chance, every thought a chance.
That's what I convinced myself. I mean, I. Obviously, looking at some of them, you recognize some imagery that would come from what you said, Wiki Commons. I can see that now. I was thinking like TV or magazine. There are images that I can tell were pulled from some media, but then there are some images that are just so personal. I was imagining you sitting there while this stuff was happening. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I didn't even consider those to have come from a photographic source. It's wild.
Yeah, and also when I'm with family, my camera is my studio work, my studio process.
It's like a sketchbook
It's always going. Yeah. Any chance I get, it's I could use that. Mm-hmm. I like that pose. I could use that. So. Mm-hmm. I feel like, in a way, I'm always working.
Yeah, you're framing, sketching by just taking the photo, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me, too, yeah. Lee was looking at him earlier today, Lee White, another instructor here, a former student. He was talking about them, and he mentioned that he could feel in the line quality, he could feel the sense of propulsion and anxiety in that line. And I was thinking, hey, it sort of reminds me a little bit of like an EKG, like the kind of the zigzag quality of mark making. And I guess it just led me to think about that, the type of line quality that you're employing in these drawings. Mm-hmm. Where has that kind of always been there? Or is that something you've developed? This kind of calligraphic Franz Klein kind of scratchy.
I think I've allowed it to. I mean, I think before it was there, but it's like erase it, go back through, erase, you know. And then there's this kind of oppressive, like, yeah, overcorrection.
Mm. You know, like, you're trying to stabilize and clean up what was your natural sort of expression.
Yeah, and I think it's you know what I always loved was blind contour line drawing, because I loved. That the critic in your head had no purpose there in that process, because you can't see, so you know, but I love this idea of connecting the eye to the mind, to the hand, like, and also that was a skill that could be through practice, it could be developed. Mm-hmm. And I always loved how drawing is something that I learned actually as a teacher that can be taught, and a skill that can be enhanced through practice. Mm-hmm. But eventually what happened for me is I just allowed, like, is this right? Is the finger here? No, it's over here. I just allowed that line to continue to show my my thought process. And I loved the honesty of that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it adds... It adds layers of depth and movement. The figure seems to be kind of moving and jostling. Maybe that's part of why I could so easily imagine you being in a room with folks at the time of its conception. You know, like, it's just, they're very atmospheric. They're linear, but they're atmospheric. You know, that's a suggestion of space and light purely through line is pretty remarkable. I wonder about the feeling. Sorry for the music. We'll have to just, the mics might do a better job of editing out the music, but it is what it is. They're getting ready for jazz practice. I wonder about the sense of mood in the characters, like the. As you're drawing faces, as you're drawing their poses, the sense of mood in them tends to be, there's a story being told. I don't know what the story is, but there's a story being told in the emotive qualities of the figures. Is there anything you like to talk about with that? Is it the subject matter that you're attracted to? Do you think that drawings transform into that as you're making them?
Yeah, I think a lot of the, what I'm responding to when I see a facial expression or a pose is something very weary, kind of the burdens that children carry that they're not supposed to carry, but they do. We don't realize sometimes how complicated a child's psychological, you know, and their internal worlds are, and what they absorb and what they're processing. And I think there is, and I'm very interested actually in genetic memories and how research may be suggesting that our ancestors' experiences are carried forth in our DNA. And I think I experienced that very much, just in the, I don't know, even as a child, the sort of sadness I felt about the world. The heaviness of it. It didn't feel like a very. I'm not sure that's unique. I think a lot of children kind of hide that that experience, or that, you know, those feelings, and they just kind of, I mean, they still play and do things that children do, but I think there's a lot more going on internally.
Yeah, like that weight of the world. That's a great way to put it. I was just thinking about the one with the bunny ears and how it's on the surface a happy-go-lucky image, but it isn't really. I mean, there's definitely weight of the world in those figures, right? Even in this kind of relaxed pose.
I mean, that comes from, I mean, honestly, the moment when that image was captured was meant to be playful, but I know a lot about the experiences of the people that are in the drawings, because they're family members, and you know, and I know the kinds of, so, and in that image, that's my nephew and my brother, and there's a generation. So my nephew is younger. My brother is very childlike and vulnerable, and has got a sweetness about him, and I kind of felt like. He looks sad that my nephew did this funny thing. Almost like he's been humiliated, and I don't know. It's just a moment of I could see the fragility that's, you know, sometimes in people, just when I'm with my camera, I just notice some of these expressions that people don't think anyone sees on their faces in a moment where they should be celebrating with everyone else. And they're just like, why do they look so sad?
Especially in the Midwest, where we all put the masks on and pretend that nothing is wrong around other family or whatever.
Yeah, you know, definitely. What I mean?
Typical Midwest family, anyway. So I guess I was curious, Kristen, do you remember when she showed up with her stack of drawings to come? Yeah. What's your memory of that from your perspective? How has the work changed from when she was a student? So some of that carries forward all the way through, huh? Yeah. What do you think, Les?
I remember walking in on that meeting. And you were squatting on the ground, like the edge of the rice field, squatting very comfortably, kinds of cool hand gestures. I suppose my reaction was like, "Where's?"
So yeah, you came across. I know. I have a memory at all. Yeah, that's great, but. That's right. 30 years from now, we'll be reminiscing. Was it really 30 years ago? Is it? Wow, amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, amazing. How has this place changed? I mean, coming back, seeing it all. Obviously different faculty and whatnot, but is it, it's basically the same space? Or... Nothing's really changed at all?
I think, but in a way, though, I think that's what's so great about it, you know? Because I miss when I first moved closer to Chicago and I'd been teaching here for a while. I used to have dreams about the building, all the, you know, being in the building. And then when I came to drop my work off, I missed it. I just, I think for me, I guess I'm glad that it hasn't changed that much. But my whole world when I was attending was mostly in this building, besides occasionally a class out, just because I was a non-traditional student with a child, I didn't get to do a lot of the social activities. Mm-hmm. It was a different experience for me.
That makes a lot of sense, yeah. So when you... I've been focusing on the more family-oriented pictures, but the ones that are of, you know, media-produced imagery, boxers, the horses, the wolves, and the trees. What do you think draws you to that, those particular sources, and you seem to repeat them, or is it just for this show that these happen to be the ones? Or
No. I've in the last several years, I've been working with horses and wolves and these motifs that are almost like, you know, they're protective because I'm creating work about very personal things. I don't know that the viewer realizes that so much, but I think that I'm drawn to them because they're like, they're guarding the content. And I love this idea of empowering these people in my life that are really struggling with things that make them sort of fragile. So I've just decided to protect them with these motifs. In a intuitive, I didn't know that that's what it was about, but.
So for instance, the boxers, they represent strength on one side, but they represent, I don't know, violence or being subjected to pain on the other side. Are they a protective? Are they a symbol of the complexity of that, or are they?
Well, I love boxing actually because it is an opportunity for people who come from really humble beginnings to empower themselves to. You know, and there's like, it's not just physically, it's not just physical strength, but it's also
determination,
agility, just like these skills that, again, you can learn, but it is an opportunity to rise above. And I think it sort of represents the struggles in generations of my family. You know, it's like calling upon like your spirit animal or like, you know, or finding that thing inside of you that helps you persevere. I'm drawn also to the moment of something that is very strong and noble and then kind of seen on the other side of that, it's again, it's fragility, the moment it falls, the moment it needs stitches, the moment you know, it's kind of sad, but I think it's also kind of brave to let the world see you in those moments, you know, in a very
Does anyone have any questions? Thoughts, please.
I think black and white is often associated with expressionism. Emotions are given primacy. In your work, I'm wondering, like, clearing out color, mm-hmm. what is allowed, what do you allow to come in and grapple with?
I think it's definitely playing with the hierarchy of compositional, you know, of the comp of space, because I think definitely in Western art there's primacy given to the positive, you know, what occupies the, and I love playing with the idea of the negative space as being dominant almost, you know, allowing the narrative to be pulled back a little bit into this protective distance. So I think it adds like a barrier, you know, and I can play with this idea of traditional Western art hierarchies formally. I also love, I mean, you take away color and you can really just focus on content, as I struggle so much with color has always been kind of overwhelming for me. And I'm not even sure, like, I think it took me a while to learn to see it. So there's always this experience I actually had with Les Bell in painting class, where he had us do a white still life, or I think it was your assignment, Les, but I can't remember if you were on sabbatical then, but it was an experience I had in the studio.
Where all the objects were white.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. And I went out of the building to drive home, and I was like, like all of the colors were just like techno, you know, yeah. it was, I couldn't even drive. I had to sit in my car for a minute and like adjust my eyes.
Should have been extracting just these little stains of former food you probably
couldn't. Yeah, it's transformative. It's, I mean, everyone should do that. Everyone should. It really, and then I think gradually from there, I began to notice like the trees are like a cooler green in the spring, you know, and they gradually warm up as the summer. It's like those tiny little, oh my gosh, all that. It's so beautiful. But I want to make, I think the problem is, well, with drawing too, is I want things to be alive. I want them to move. I don't know why I didn't go into film or animation, because that's really, I want there to be all of this like push pull, everything going on. And so like my paintings, it's like I'll put something optically that really moves forward here. It doesn't really make sense. It's almost like the content just disappears because it's me just playing with paint. Like I'm just a playground of like, and I didn't, and then it came to a point where I was like, no, I really want to get back to the narrative and tell a story. And so, not that.
The pictorial, you know, the picture positive and negative, and giving the negative spaces primacy. And from what I've seen in your work, it really does drive something mysterious as hell into the narrative. Because, you know, the narrative tends to be positive, more clearly describes stuff, and yet quietly insistent, abstract forms that are, like you said, can spin around. They introduce motion into the narrative and mystery too.
I think all of us as 2D, like, I don't know, like we really do, like, I think we do want to have that motion, like something. I mean, I love the film "What Dreams May Come." I don't know if you've seen it, but one of the characters is an artist, and her in her afterlife, her paintings are real. Hmm. It's such an amazing thing to me. But yeah, I want the formal choices to all inform the narrative, to be a part of it. And I don't want there to be any mistake that these images are not necessarily light and airy themes. There are some of the psychology in them is a little bit tougher. It's a little more complicated than just joy or...
Reminds me of an alligator breaks up a hot, fiery feeling. It completely never registered, but it's there anyway for us to carefully taste.
Yeah, definitely. I think there is a huge difference between a line with acute angles and, I think everything in the composition for me is alive.
Mm.
It's like even the negative space looks like a monster
coming down. There are these intense pressures in these, even when they're not defined as with any kind of characteristic, but just these big masses of, even if it's just bright white, they're crushed, sometimes crushing in on the thing, and it's really, I was thinking earlier about the one with the guy cleaning his glasses,
mm-hmm.
and how that reminded me of the animation thing. It's like, that feels like an animated image in a sense, but that's through the energy of the line. You feel the animator's touch of, like early animation, kind of that touch. But then the sense of movement and the sense of jostling and the sense of pressure from these, it's just all these things are working together in really great balance. You've really honed in on this sort of balance of black and white here.
It's really difficult for me to know how, what I like to do is play with that question of how much can I get away with leaving out to imply the feel, flowers or this or that, or because I don't have the attention to articulate every blade of grass, I don't know if there's a part of me that wishes, but I just don't have that in me, like some people who are impeccable, like just amazing draftsmen that can...
Detail-oriented and completionists. And
yeah.
Everything is completely defined.
Oh my gosh, I want to I can't do it. I just can't.
Well, that has its own pressures. I mean, I just think the suggested field of grass, by leaving out so much of it, it does. We fill in with our own associations and potential, our own anxieties.
And if you know you're not going to do that, then you have to ask yourself, what is the essence of the thing? What's the, the gist of it? So I'm asking myself that a lot, when I'm working. But I have to say, though, I do have a lot of failures. It's not it's not easy. And I think, like, in the last few months, I'm almost every few months just going, I'm giving this up. I'm not an artist. I'm a fraud. This is not for me. the validation, you know, I'm so jealous of other, and maybe this is just me idealizing other occupations, but I just, it's sad because I really crave that validation, but it just, there's so much of the time you spend working, it's completely alone, and you're just kind of grasping in the dark, and you don't know what you're, especially when you want to experiment and you want to try to innovate. It's just really, I mean, I've cried a lot about these things, and then I just hope for the best.
I don't think our society is set up in America to validate the artists or the art process and the complexity of the idiosyncrasy of it. Countries in Europe that seem to give artists the benefit of the doubt. You know, they won't grab you by the collar and say, what does this mean? What is this? Take it upon themselves to do a little bit of homework before.
Yeah.
To prepare.
I think artists, in general, what I've noticed is you go into the galleries of Chicago or New York or wherever, but in my case, Chicago, and what you see in those galleries, it's like a fortune teller, like the colors that are trending with artists. It's not like they all consult each other, but it kind of all bubbles up in different places, but all at the same time in those, in different galleries. And then next thing you know, in high fashion, it's walking down the runway. It's in interior, it's trending in interior design. It's the quality of the images or the scale or whatever the choices are that are kind of happening in the galleries eventually comes out in the style of music or the way theater is being performed or the way poets are writing. I feel like it's very, you know, it's kind of like the first transmission of the collective unconscious or the zeitgeist kind of comes through artists. And that's not to like build myself up as this, like, because that's a really difficult thing to be open to those transmissions, because you don't know if this is good or bad or what's going to happen with it. And I think it's, I don't know. We'll see what happens at the end of the story, but
I think that's a lot of times the tension between the teacher and the student too. You know, I mean, I'm constantly asking myself whether this is bad student work or if this is zeitgeist changing work. And I don't know that there's a clear answer to that, you know?
I think assessment for me, when I was teaching here, I dreaded it. I didn't know, like I would, because I'm kind of an optimist in some ways, so I would see stuff in the work. I'm like, oh, that's so great. I'm going to, like, absorbing every, you know, these different parts of it. But it's like, but can, you know, did they really fulfill the assignment? Be honest, you know, like, but it's really, it's so tough. That knowing, you know, like.
Yeah, I mean, they're living in a different world than we are. We have to acknowledge that, but we also, we find the lineage and we find the history and we make connections and we teach the basics. But then it's like, they're not going to do what I'm going to do, no matter, you know, how much I want them to. I don't know. What else? Any other questions? That's okay. You're the one that wanted extra credit.
I guess when you take the photos, do you usually have a color, or do you have
I take it in color, and but I play with later what I'll do is, you know, turn it to a black and white image. I'll play with the contrast, the sharpness. The reference images become very distorted or so altered from the original. And sometimes the reason I do that is because I do want to really see what that negative space is and how I can distort it, or I want to really focus on the shape of the figure, or just to help me decide how I want to represent the figure and draw it, so that I can see, like, if it's a difficult pose, so I can see what that negative space is in the way they're holding their arm, and get an accurate you know, drawing of that. And then sometimes so, and I'll also do several, I'll take the photo, I'll play with it, I'll edit it into different versions. And then from there, the first drawing I do of the photo is very much just like the photo. And then from there, I'll kind of abstract. There'll be many generations from that original drawing, often done in my sketchbook in pencil. So it looks very different from what you see there. I'll actually take the time to carefully, you know, shade above the eye and get all the, I feel like that gives me, it builds my confidence to sort of then abstract the image or distort certain things to enhance the narrative or inform the content, if that makes sense.
That's wild. That, you know, that is kind of a Franz Kline thing. I'm just thinking back to how you see, like, chair backs or whatever in his monumental paintings, like, oh yeah, there's, you know, like, you're finding elements, you're finding essentials or movements through. I mean, the line, what I'm so compelled by is that the line is not just edge of shape, but it is its own, becomes its own entity. It becomes both and, the edge of shape for one thing, or the edge of the negative space, or its own entity that you follow along just as line. It's become an independent entity, I guess.
Yeah, I think in my mind, I mean, I'm in a way, I'm kind of childlike, because I'm like, oh, big, mean, angry lion coming here, and it's gonna, you know, attack this. Like, I'm always narrating my process like a little kid, immersed in imaginative play. You know, I just kind of, I think that's, if you know, that's just, yeah. So that would make sense, but I hadn't really thought about, like, did other people notice that in the drawings?
Yeah. Or it ties back to what you said earlier with the line contour drawing, but the line travels, the eye travels where the line travels. You're playing in these spaces separate from whether left side or the right side becomes an object or a space. That's wild. It's a great question. Thank you. I mean, seeing that levels of remove from the original source to allow for more freedom.
Yeah, definitely. It's like a, you know, if you, like a mantra, if you say a word over and over and over again, you draw an image over and over and over again, that word, like, it, you know, it's weird. It sort of, it shifts and changes. Then you begin to even forget it's an actual word, like you're just hearing, like, the sound, and the same happens visually, you know, with the drawing process. You draw it again and again and again, and it's like, and I start to notice the nuances or other things in the expression of the figure. Lots of different qualities come forward then, are unveiled.
The line is mantra.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, and I love the power of, you know, if you respond to a message, someone, or a text message, and you're like, yes, 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 you know, oh, 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 like, you repeat the power of that. It's
What else?
Rachel?
I think the first reason, to be honest, is practicality. I have a family and a lot of stuff going on, so it just gives me the freedom to take my sketchbooks, take my drawing pads, go wherever I need to go, and it allows me to keep working. Because if I only worked large, then I would be limited by the available time I had to go into the studio and, you know, all the other things about that, like shipping the work, photographing the work, which has always been a challenge for me, like getting that set up. And this, with the smaller work, I can reproduce it very easily. I can just put it on a scanner. I mean, you know, I know that's a very... so there's that, but also it helps my, it helps me be honest in my process because I can make a lot of it. There isn't that inhibition that comes with expensive materials or, a canvas or a stretcher that you labored over in a wood shop and put the canvas over and stapled it. It's like, oh my God, now it better be a masterpiece. So, where... with the ink paper, with the, it's cotton ink drawing paper. It's better paper, but it comes in pads. There's lots of it available. It just frees up my process in a way that the large scale work doesn't. So, I mean, if I had access to 100 stretched canvas that were all big, then
you keep 10% of those.
And I'd be like, okay, next. And, I mean, probably, to be honest, I probably work in a similar way, but I just find I'm much more careful with a large work that I don't like. It's
I was, from the paintings that I've seen from your website, it looks like you're playing with some limited palette structures on occasion. Is that maybe where the paintings come back with limited palettes? Or I mean, these are black and white acrylic paintings. Is that right. Does that black and gray, I guess we should say, but is there a limited palette painting in the future where you're finding the freedom from the extravagances of full spectrum color and you can kind of focus in on positive and negative in that way? Or
I, for many years, I was experimenting with a palette that was just the cyan, magenta, and yellow, and Mars black. So those four, and I loved it because it just dragged my work and put it right there in the 21st century in a way that I felt like, because I was so in love with Indian red or red ochre or like this idea of building a painting with earth pigments and, you know, like just pulling it up from the earth and kind of resurrecting it like a, I don't know, in almost like a biblical way, like, you know, creating the
golem.
And then eventually I was like, oh, I can't look at this, this red anymore. Like my paintings all look like they're under paintings from like you know, the Renaissance or some. So it's like no more. So I threw that out and brought in magenta. And I was like, oh. I think so. I think I'm longing. I just, now that I've done this scale for a while, I really want to get back to large scale work, get back to color. But I like, again, I get very easily overwhelmed by a full palette. So I probably would continue with that, that limited palette.
Cool. Anything else, anybody? Okay. we'll call it. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
This has been Q&A from the Kadich and Morrissey Galleries at St. Ambrose University. We hope you've enjoyed this program. All rights reserved, 2023.